Okay, if you guys could find a place and get settled in, we'll get going here. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming out tonight. Welcome you to this RAC meeting. We've got a pretty full schedule, so we'll keep it cruising right along. My name is Gary Nielsen. I'm the RAC chair. We'll start over here on our right and have them introduce themselves and the group that they represent.
I'm Chris Schmitz, and non-consumptive wildlife.
Larry Fitzgerald, represent agriculture.
Richard Hansen, at large.
Chris Marble, at large.
George Holmes, agriculture.
Jay Price, elected officials.
And finally, Dan Potts, non-consumptive uses.
Okay, thank you. To my right, we have John Fairchild. He's the regional director here. We appreciate those of you who have taken time to come tonight. A couple of things. Most of you have been to RAC meetings before. We encourage you to express your opinions and state your concerns. We have kind of a protocol that we follow. First off, we will have a presentation made by somebody from the division, after which we will have a question period. We will have questions from the RAC. And after questions from the RAC, we'll close that period for the RAC and open it up to the audience, at which time you'll have a chance to ask questions about the proposals, at which time after that, we'll close a question period and you'll be allowed to comment. As you entered the foyer here or this room, there's some comment cards over there that we'll need you to fill out and get to us, and then we will actually call you to the microphone to either state your comments or your feelings or your suggestions, and that'll be during the comment period from the public. After the comment period from the public is closed, we will close that section and bring it back to the RAC for further discussion and their disposition and the proposal for a motion. We realize that a lot of you guys feel strongly about stuff, okay, which is the reason that brings us all here, and so we just ask you to please be courteous and respect one another's opinions and allow people to represent their opinion also in the interest of time. Listen carefully to what others have to say, so if somebody has a like opinion, you know, we maybe give the time to somebody else who has a differing opinion as opposed to saying the same thing that was just said. If you're an individual and you're speaking on behalf of yourself, you have 3 minutes. If you're speaking on behalf of an organization, you are allowed 5 minutes. What we'll need you to do when you come to the mic is state your name and whether you are representing yourself or an organization. Okay. First thing, just an update on the Wildlife Board meeting. For those of you who remember that many months ago, the proposals that were brought through the RAC and processed through the RAC went before the board, and without exception, they passed unanimously with the recommendation from the division. And so that's how that stuff went. So it went really well. We're also ready for a regional update, and we'll turn the time over to John.
We need to approve the agenda. I knew she was going to get us back on track here.
She did.
It was way too early.
All right, I'd also like to welcome Sarah to the front. Anyway, another thing. Have you had a chance to look at the minutes from the last stuff? And okay, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes. So made. Seconded by Richard. All in favor? Okay. Minutes are approved. Also, you had a chance to look at the agenda for tonight. Okay. I need a proposal to accept that agenda to work from tonight. Okay. And Danny seconds it. We do have a small change in the agenda when you get down to item number 9. It's listed as bucks and bulls, once in a lifetime, and antlerless permit recommendations. What we're going to do with that category is take bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime, and then we'll separate that from the antlerless and do those as two separate motions. That'll make it a little clearer. Anyway, with that recommendation, are we still okay for the four? Okay. It's been motioned and seconded. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously.
Okay, here's a regional update by section. The programs that have been taking place for the last little while. Starting with aquatics, we have a pretty sophisticated system for monitoring June sucker migration up the Provo River using telemetry antennas and pit tags in the fish. And they were reinstalled in the Provo River this last week. They've started monitoring Columbia spotted frog in the Diamond Fork. This is a sensitive species that we're monitoring fairly closely throughout the region. Also gearing up, hiring new seasonal employees. There's a large project involving yellow perch moving about 50,000 from Fish Lake to Yuba Reservoir the first and second week of May. That's going to involve a lot of division employees and volunteers. Looking forward to that, trying to kickstart a perch fishery there that's been depleted. Northern pike probably have something to do with that. Gill netting Deer Creek and Jordanelle early in May, and RAC members, if you're interested in participating in that, let us know and we'll hook you up. Transferring largemouth bass and bluegill from Gunlock Reservoir to the Salem Pond and Willow Pond next week, trying to maintain a fishery in some of these community waters that's self-sustaining. They've spray-marked cutthroat that are going to be stocked in Strawberry Reservoir later this spring. This is a way to monitor the success of different age classes as they come up to spawn. Finalizing research plans for determining the impact of pelicans to the spawning runs at Strawberry. That's become quite a problem, and they're looking at trying to assess just how big a problem that has become. Preparing for the kokanee and trout stocking in Strawberry later this month into mid-May. Also, the Aquatic Invasive Species Programs coordinating with state parks to prevent the spread or infestation of invasive species. We'll be meeting with them tomorrow in a meeting, and that'll be quite a topic of discussion. Then Utah Lake, it's the most likely lake to be visited by boaters from Lake Powell, and so we're beefing up our efforts to address aquatic invasive species concerns there. Given the fact that Lake Powell is now infested with quagga mussel. In our wildlife section, our sage-grouse let counts are going on now. And again, RAC members, if you're interested in participating in that, let us know. If you've never seen sage-grouse strutting, that's quite a scene. Antelope flights will be scheduled for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Snake Valley. We've completed one of our three deer herd unit plans, and the winter range rides are coming up. Biologist Dale Lichty, Dennis Sutherland, Tom Becker are going to have rides in April and May. And if you're interested, you need to be getting a hold of them to find out the dates. I have dates here if you're interested. In our habitat section, in the last week or two, the conservation organization showed up and ponied up $1.6 million for habitat restoration projects, thanks to anyone in the audience that was involved with that. Weed control spray crews were hired and will begin spraying noxious weeds on our WMAs soon. That's become quite a program, and we're assessing just how best to structure our crews in order to be more effective there. In our there's a lop and scatter project, and it's going to begin soon in the Vernon area. And grazing bids have been awarded for division lands that are going to be grazed this spring and early summer. Interesting to note that many of our units went for over $20 an AUM. I thought that was showing that it's pretty expensive to feed these cattle. Conservation Outreach, Mountain Goat Viewing Day on Saturday, Salem Pond event on the 13th of May, and we have a YHEC state meet that's going to be held at our Lee K. Center on April 25th and 26th. YHEC is, it stands for Youth Hunter Education Challenge. It's hunter education graduates that look at competing in a variety of different events involving different firearms. There's also wildlife identification, there's a safety trail, and always looking for volunteers. There's about 110, 120 kids that show up from teams all over the state that'll be competing there. So, great way for hunter education graduates to take on new challenges and become introduced to different ways of hunting. Our law enforcement section, Jay Topham was promoted to sergeant of the Wasatch crew, replacing Paul Davis, who retired. And I hear they all passed their physical fitness test this week. Bruce, you're in here somewhere. Yes, they all passed. So we have fit COs. I want everybody to know that. Quagga training, quagga muscle training also completed. We do have two vacancies right now, the JUAB and the Heber CO districts, and we hope to have those filled by August. Have some great candidates that are coming out of post. And our wildlife tech in Wasatch County was short-lived there. She's now a veterinary assistant, so we'll be looking to replace Heather in Wasatch and Summit County, dealing with an increasing number of wildlife-human interactions as you get more and more people back there. So that's what we have. Any questions from the rack? Yes.
Not a question, but an addition. Patricia Engel of the Salt Lake office is heading up and organizing the Outdoor Adventure Days on the 13th and 14th of June. It'll be a great opportunity for families to come out and get hands-on for fishing and hunting. They're going to have everybody, all the retailers and everybody there. It should be an awesome event.
Thanks.
Thank you, Danny. Also, I failed to recognize John Bear in the audience. We'd appreciate it when those guys come down and see what's shaking on the local level. So when they get up there, they can also bring back the feeling of the group.
They tell me they're donuts, so.
Yeah, where are they? They're not for you.
Okay, our first agenda item tonight is the Wildlife License Permit, COR Form Rule Amendment, and we have Kenny Johnson, who is the Administrative Service Section Chief, to make that presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. RAC members, members of the public. Yeah, I'm Kenny Johnson from the Admin Services Section in Salt Lake, and I have three right in a row that are relatively brief, so don't blink or you might miss these. The first one is R-657-45, which is wildlife licenses and permits and certificates of registration, and that's just a picture of an old senior discounted dollar license and a regular $3 fishing stamp. So just a strange picture we found to accompany the presentation. Real quick background. Last summer, the RAC and board, we took out a proposal to change some of our fees, and then that had to go to the legislature and the governor this last session, and they both passed what you guys had approved last summer. And so that kind of set the foundation for what we're going to talk about really quick tonight. These proposals will become effective July 1st to accompany the approved fees. So really, we listened to what our constituents were saying, and there was a lot of interest in having multiple-year hunting, fishing, and combination licenses. our code up until then had that text in that second bullet valid 365 days from date of issue. The statute read that, and that kind of limited us to just being able to offer licenses that were good for that 365-day window. So in this last session, we removed that text, and now the statute grants the authority to the Wildlife Board to make sense of licenses and set those terms. So we're excited about that. The 365-day format was great. We think it adds value to customers. It's been really popular. We want to keep it, but we want to enhance it a little bit. And this next slide will show those proposed changes. So the single-year licenses that are valid from 365 days from when you buy them now, that process would stay the same. And what we want to do is allow multiple year purchases for fishing, hunting, and combination licenses. So adults could then buy licenses in 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 year increments from the day they buy them, instead of just being limited to a single year. And then we want to add some functionality to our system that lets people renew their licenses before it expires, but have it pick up where your old one left off, so you don't lose any field days. And then that last bullet, we want to offer 3 and 7 day fishing licenses and then keep the 3 day non-resident hunting license that we currently have. And that is all. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny. Any questions from the audience?
Sorry.
Questions from the rack? Okay, seeing none, we'll close the question period. Any comments from the audience?
That was a little shorter than last time, Kenny.
Wait till the next two.
That's all right. Okay. Seeing none, I'll close the comment period and bring it back to the rec for your proposal.
I'll make a motion to accept the school's proposal.
Okay, motion's been made. Seconded. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Kenny, you're up.
Thank you. So this next one really is just this one slide. It's a real minor housekeeping change. This is for R657-67, which is our mentor hunting rule, which we got approved through the legislature in statute 2 years ago, and we wrote some rule to begin allowing this mentor hunting idea to happen. And as yet, this still isn't off and running at the street level. But we noticed right out of the gate, we got a little bit of feedback from the public and some of our partners that we had a little bit of a restrictive piece of rule in there already. And so that the current rule, that second bullet up there, it says in order to apply to share a permit, that an application has to happen 10 days before that event. And we didn't want, you know, a dad or a mom who wanted to share a hunting permit to miss a whole entire deer season or elk season because of that 10-day window. And so what we're doing here is just proposing that we remove that 10-day processing time to be more flexible for the public. And then we just want to say that the application and approval must happen at a division office prior to sharing a permit. And that's all on that one. Thank you.
Thank you. Members of the RAC, do you have any questions about the presentation? Richard, then Danny.
Does that include during the hunting season itself?
Yeah. What we hope this would do is if dad wanted to share and mentor a couple of kids, that he could do that on one weekend and then have time to do it again the next weekend for a different kid.
Okay. So if he does a mentoring and then he does it one weekend with one of his kids or a grandchild or something, then but he can still go out later and continue to hunt if that tag hasn't been used. Is that right?
Right. Yep.
Danny?
Yeah, so I was trying to follow this outline on the rule, and I got down to F and was confused. I couldn't follow the outline, so it went, a completed application for a mentor program that includes the following, and it goes A, B, C, D, E. And then when I got to F, that sentence didn't make any sense in that order, and it didn't seem to be consistent with the format of the others. E would be written certificates of the following, and then there's a couple of things that you need to do. That when you get to F, it says any wildlife documents, plural, that must be surrendered in order to qualify for the hunter mentoring program. If I had a problem reading that, I suspect that others would also. It's a wordsmithing thing, maybe. I don't know.
It's a valid question, and really the intent is there could be instances where the youth has a permit that in order to share a permit with dad, he has to surrender. That's what F is talking about. So it's not a really a carte blanche program where you can just use whatever permit willy-nilly. There's some restrictions there, and that's what F is referring to.
Yeah, it just was a wordsmithing. I didn't understand that.
And you're right. Wildlife document is probably a little bit confusing. It's how we define pretty much anything that we issue over a counter. That's kind of the generic rule, or the generic term for some of our licenses and permits. And so that could be part of it, too. I think you're right. It could just be some of the wordsmithing.
It seems like it's missing a word.
Okay. Did that help? We can. We
well,
can maybe.
The
okay.
It's hard to understand.
Any other questions from the rack? So if a kid then has a deer license and then his dad lets him decide to shoot his, or lets him wants to mentor him to go down on the ponds for a deer, he has to surrender his other deer license. Is that
right.
What that's saying?
Right.
Okay, that's
yep.
Right. Any other questions? Questions from the audience? Any comments from the audience? All right, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the rec for your discussion and potential motion.
So does that mean that if there were two licenses purchased, now there was only the opportunity to fill one tag?
It'd be a decision they have to make in certain cases where it was the same species. Yeah.
Make a motion to approve as presented.
Okay. Motion's been made to approve.
Second.
Seconded. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Okay, our next one's the fishing with more than one pole amendment.
Okay, thank you, and I'll stay right here. This is another just single slide, so this one will be quick too. As presented in our fee change to you guys last summer, what we wanted to do is include in the increase to fishing and combination license the second pole privilege. And so beginning July 1st, a second pole permit will be included as part of a valid fishing or combination license. And so what we want to do is in 657.13, just remove all the references to the second pole, and just it, kind of water by water, you have to just follow the rule. But a two pole for the vast majority will just be included in a combination or valid fishing license. And so that's just kind of making good on that promise that we made to you guys last summer. And then nothing changes with daily possession limits, anything like that. It's just the two pole document isn't for sale anymore.
Okay.
And that's it there.
All right. Any questions from the rec? Any questions from the audience? Comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the rec. Danny.
Since I was might have been the one who originally recommended this rule back at the Utah Anglers Coalition quite a while ago, I'd like to make the motion to accept this. It's kind of a no-brainer.
Okay. Motion's made by Danny, seconded by Chris. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, our next presentation is the aquatics. Do you have something? Did I skip one?
You can come present for me if you want.
Okay. I'd like to welcome Candace Hutchison. She's the aquatics invasive species biologist for the division, and she's presenting the aquatic invasive species rule amendment. We'll turn the time over to her.
Okay, over the legislation session this year, there was a few changes made to our 657-60. During the 2014 legislative session, State Senator Peter Knudsen and State Representative Mel Brown sponsored a change to the AS Interdiction Act to enhance the ability of the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources to protect the state from the invasion of quagga mussels. The legislation approved the change that allowed UDWR to establish non-law enforcement inspection stations along the roadway with a Class B misdemeanor for not stopping at them. The intent of allowing roadside inspections is to stop boats that could potentially be transporting mussels in adult or villager life stages before they reach a water body. Thus, we're reducing the risk of invasion into new locations. By providing authority to stop boaters along the roadway, UDWR can also shape its AIS program to look more familiar to a lot of other boaters and be similar to other states that surround us, such as Montana and Wyoming and even Idaho. When we made this rule, there was a few changes that needed to be updated further defined to the UDWR authority. Thus, we are presenting the new section to Administrative Rule R657-60. The new section of the rule further defines inspection stations requiring us to place them in locations that are safe, where we have enough room for boaters to be able to pull off safely and where we can safely inspect them, and also along inspection stations along Highway 89 or 85, or just where we'd be able to catch these boats coming from out of state carrying possible quagga mussels. And then allow us to verify that decontamination has started. It's part of our law that before you leave an infested water that you decontaminate your boat, and what we're asking boaters to do is to clean, drain, and dry their boat, and then they can proceed on home to finish that decontamination drying time. So we will be inspecting boats to make sure that they've pulled their plug and dried as much as they could, and then we'll also have the opportunity to decontaminate those boats who wish to go boating again before the required decontamination times. And then also we'd be verifying that cleaning and allowing tags or seals to be placed on the boat between the boat and the trailer, indicating when that boat started its drying time, so that the parks or our partners will have that ability to identify boats that have been infested waters and identify when they started their decontamination process. Currently, UWR is planning a budget necessary to implement inspection stations and locations for the 2014 session. Partnerships with National Park Service at Glen Canyon National Park area and Lake Powell are being established, and there may be interdiction stations as boats leave the lake as well. It is likely that there will also be inspection stations established near Bear Lake for this upcoming boating season. And that's all I have. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Candace. Any questions from the RAC? Richard.
How long can a quagga mussel live out of the water?
It depends on temperatures. During the summertime when we have most of our boating, it's 7 days out of water, and that's in dry conditions, making sure you don't have any water for them to be contained. Winter, again, it's 30 days or 3 days consecutive freeze. Right now we're in spring, so it's an 18-day dry time between spring and fall seasons.
So our boaters require... if they keep that out of the water for 18 days, are they still required to decontaminate?
No, that's considered their decontamination. As long as they have cleaned all of the water out, drained all the water out, gone all the mud and stuff off, that's part of our decontamination. Professional decontamination is you can go and have a hot water treatment, but that's usually only done if you don't meet the 7-day dry time or you didn't take the measures to have your boat drained and cleaned beforehand.
Okay, thanks.
Larry.
Is this just boats coming out of infected waters, or is it all waters? How do you
tell the depends where our stations are going to be. Right now we're focusing, because of Lake Powell, we're focusing on highways linked to access from Lake Powell and then coming into our state out of Arizona and Nevada, since that's where we primarily see most of our boats coming up from. Again, we have Colorado an issue, and we're just looking at possible stations. And this will be all boats coming through that run past that check station will need to pull off and get their boat inspected, whether they've been infested or not. So,
any other questions? Questions from the audience? Come to the mic, please. State your name.
Wayne Wingreen. I represent myself. For out-of-state boaters just coming through, so that it sounds like the law is allowing DWR to pull over all boats, regardless of their intended, of where their intended purpose is.
Yes.
It seems maybe a little too much.
It is following what a lot of the other states are doing. So it is expected for many boaters that they will be pulling over and doing the check station. So we are aligning our regulations with other states. And what there's a Western Regional Panel, which any state that's west of the Hunt Meridian is on, and all the states' main lawmakers and policymakers are part of, and it's something that we're all trying to collaborate and become united in how we do our approach, and this is one of those steps to be able to do that. There will be signs placed up indicating that boaters need to stop by. If they've done all their measures, then they should be able to pass through. Nevada, Arizona, California are already doing a lot of these steps, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana. So most boaters by now, unless they're new, should have a good understanding that they need to have their boat drain plugged. Plus, we'll be saving them some gas money if they don't. So.
Okay, so those stickers you're going to put on the trailer between the boat and the... That's... If they get pulled over, they can just check and see that the date's fine on that and just let them go?
That's the intent. We're still kind of modifying and figuring out the best usage of how to do that. But this rule enables us to allow us to do that.
Any other comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the rec for a proposal or more discussion.
I'll make a motion to accept this recommendation.
Okay, motion's been made.
Seconded.
All in favor? Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you
very much. Our next presentation will be Justin Shannon. I know, I was just a mess with him. I know, he's going to talk to us about the Bucks, Bulls, and Once in a Lifetime.
Justin Shannon, and tonight I'm going to present the Bucks, Bulls, and Once in a Lifetime permit recommendations for 2014. So to begin, we'll start with mule deer. What I want to do is give you an idea of where we are currently in regards to general season buck harvest, and how that relates to the last 10 years or so across the state. As you can see from this graph, the x-axis is the various years over the last 10 years, and the y is the number of bucks harvested on general season units. And we varied between 19,000 and 28,000 bucks. In the last 2 years, we've been above 25,000, so things have been looking up. Fawn production over the last 15 years, we've had our peaks and valleys. especially late 90s, early 2000s. But the last 5 years or so, we've been very stable at about 61 to 65 fawns per 100 does. Buck-to-doe ratios over the last 15 years, we've kind of hovered around 15 bucks per 100 does. We peaked in 2007 and came back down. And then the last 2 years, we've been at 18 and 19 bucks per 100 does. So for general season units, our buck-to-doe ratios are in a really good spot right now. So with that background, I want to present the general season deer permit recommendations for 2014. Statewide, we're recommending an increase of 200 permits from 84,600 to 84,800. But with the 30 units that we have, that we're recommending decreases on 6 of the units, no change on 17, and then increases on 7 of the units. The next couple of graphs or slides are going to be this table, so I just want to take a minute and go over this. On the far left is each of the general season units, and next we have our objective, whether we're managing for 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does or 18 to 20. And after that, we have our three-year buck-to-doe ratio average. Those that are highlighted in yellow mean that they're below objective, and those in green represent that they're above objective. Next, we have the buck-to-doe ratio trend. It's not a true trend. It's just what I wanted to do is show something in the buck-to-doe ratio this year relative to last year. And so if it's increased, then that arrow's up. And then finally, on the far right is the number of permits that we're recommending for this fall. So with that, we're recommending decreases in permits on the Beaver and the North Slope units and increases on the Pine Valley. Decreases on the Box Elder and the Cache units, but increases on the Southwest Desert and Zion units. And then finally, decreases on the South Slope Bonanza Vernal unit and the West Desert West. But increases on Monroe, Okra Stansberries, Panguitch Lake, and Wasatch Mountains West. For premium limited entry deer units, these are probably our most complicated big game recommendation that we have. And the reason is because we have two types of permits on these units. We have our normal trophy permits on the Henry Mountains and the Paunsagunt, and then we have management buck permits as well. So for normal trophy permits, what we manage to is an average age. So we want 40 to 55% of the bucks harvested to be 5 years or older. And as you can see on the Henrys, 72% of the bucks harvested are 5 years or older. So we're exceeding that. And same thing with the Paunsagunt, 64% of bucks harvested are 5 years or older. With management buck permits, they're a little different. Those are issued to keep the population at a buck-to-doe ratio. And so the buck-to-doe ratio that we manage for on these units is 40 to 50. And as you can see, the three-year average on the Henry Mountains is 56, and on the Paunsagunt it's 44, with a declining trend. So with that background, we're recommending an increase of 3 permits on the Henry Mountains from 48 to 51, and an increase of 9 permits on the Paunsagunt from 135 to 144. With management buck permits, take a look at the second table down. We're recommending an increase of 5 permits on the Henry Mountains from 30 to 35, and a decrease on the Paunsagunt from 22 to 14. For the remainder of the units, the limited entry units, these are managed for 25 to 35 bucks per 100 does. And as you can see on the Fillmore Oak Creek, Dolores Triangle, and the Vernon units, we're below objective. And on the South Slope Diamond Mountain unit, we're above objective. So statewide with these permits, what we're recommending is a decrease of 16. The bulk of that's going to take place on the West Desert Vernon unit. And statewide, we're recommending 811 down from 827. The other thing I want to bring to your attention is last November, when we came to the RACs and the Wildlife Board, what was passed was to split the book cliffs north and south on the any weapon portion of that hunt. And so with those permits, it'll be 190 on the north and 66 on the south. Some people like to see how it's broken up with archery, any weapon, and muzzleloader hunts. And these are the same numbers. It just reflects that the bulk of the cuts are going to come from the any weapon portion. Okay, moving on to elk. For elk, on our general season permits, the statewide plan calls for spike permits to remain at 15,000 as long as the hunter success rate is below 20%. And this last year, we were at 17%, thus we're not recommending any changes to the spike elk permits. Additionally, we're not recommending any changes to the 14,300 any bull permits, the 300 youth any bull permits, or the 20 late youth permits. For limited entry, it's a little different. Statewide, we're recommending an increase of 100 permits from 2,742 to 2,842. It's about a 3.6% increase. And with limited entry elk, it's a little different. With bucks or with deer, we manage to a buck to doe ratio. With elk, it's an age objective that we do. And so our first age objective is 7.5 to 8 years old. And we're recommending decreases on every one of these units except the Plateau, Boulder, Comparowitz. And the reason we are is almost across the board, they're all below their management objective of 7.5 to 8. And I was looking back in 2011, how many permits were issued, and it was about 419. So this has been a common trend with these older age classes that we've been cutting annually. And our recommendation tonight is to continue those cuts until these populations respond. For the 6.5 to 7-year-old units, kind of all over the board, some are above, some are below. But as a whole, we're just recommending a decrease in 2 permits from 403 to 401. For 5.5 to 6-year-old units, this is where the bulk of the units in the state are and the majority of the elk. Statewide, we're recommending an increase of 99 permits. And those increases we're proposing for the Manti, the LaSalles, North Slope Three Corners, Nine Mile Anthro, the Fish Lake, and the Wasatch Mountains. And then finally, for 4.5 to 5-year-old units, we're recommending increase in permits on every unit except the North Cache, which is below objective. One thing that was brought to our attention as we went through the racks in the Northeast region was some of these permits that were presented in the PowerPoint didn't necessarily match the table in your handouts. And so instead of sending out brand new handouts, what we did is we identified where some of these errors were, and we've since updated them. And it'll be updated for the Wildlife Board. But the Fillmore Pavant Steel 60 permits, it's just the permits in the actual table will reflect that. I think that one on the table had like 64. We just had minor errors with that, and I apologize for that. But this will be corrected prior to the board. Moving on with pronghorn permits, statewide, we're recommending a decrease in 60 permits from 841 to 781, and the bulk of that is taking place on the Parker Mountain. And for once-in-a-lifetime permits, for moose, we're recommending a decrease of 4 from 71 to 67, a decrease in 20 permits in bison from 104 to 84, an increase on desert bighorn sheep permits from 37 to 40, a decrease in Rocky Mountain bighorn tags from 40 to 38, and a decrease in mountain goats from 162 to 108. And that's my presentation.
Thank you, Justin. Any comments or questions? Not comments, but questions from the rack. Points of clarification. Any questions from the audience?
Hi, my name is Jacob Steele. I represent the Goshute Tribe of Agapayutam. I was sent here to kind of get involved with the RAC committee a little bit. The tribes kind of wanted to know if they can get involved in the permits around the Deep Cute area, just mainly that area since we're tied together. They just want to know who the contact people would be to get involved in, to find out how much the counts were and things like that around the area. That's why I'm here tonight. So,
sure.
If I get some information or something after the meeting or something, we can maybe
we actually
work something better.
And right
we kind of want to work with the wildlife a little more, I guess we're trying to say so.
Sure. Let me introduce you to Kobe Jones, and he can introduce his biologist, and we can exchange contact information after the meeting if you'd like. So, Kobe, come on up.
So I'm Kobe Jones. Obviously, I'm the regional manager wildlife here. Tom Becker's your biologist, and then also do you talk with Milton Hooper much, or?
He's no longer on the committee or anything. So.
Okay, Milton is on the RAC, so he's a representative.
I took his name off and put me on there.
Oh, okay. So you'll be a sitting member of the RAC if we need to get that fixed. So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions from the audience? All right, close the question period. Do you have any comments? I don't have any cards.
Junior here forgot to turn in his card. Actually, got a couple of cards on.
Troy, you want to speak?
Sure.
I didn't know you were doing it.
Roy was first. I was being hospitable. Yeah, you know why. Yeah, exactly. Troy Jessenson, Sportsman, Fish and Wildlife. We just came to support the division's recommendation with three exceptions. We had asked that the RAC would look at keeping the trophy tags on the Henrys and the Poncegont the same as the 2013. Most of you are aware, probably the deer committee is going to convene here in another week. There is some concern with the quality down there as far as the top end trophy thing, so they're looking at possibly some different changes there, and so we'd ask to just keep the trophy tags to the 2013 numbers. And then as far as the elk goes, we'd ask that the central manti be the same, keep them at the 2013 numbers. I think the recommendation was to raise them to, what is it,
453.
Yeah, a difference of 23 permits. We'd ask that they'd stay at the 430. And that's it.
Thank you, Troy. Is Roy Hampton here?
My name is Roy Hampton. I'm the president of Utah Bowman's Association. We're here to support the division's recommendations with one exception. I don't know what we're going to do about the Wasatch, but we just can't keep killing bulls. Every time we look at this, in 2 years we've raised it 100 tags. And I know I spent a lot of time in this unit. There's less elk on that unit than there was 2 years ago. So, and you see the age objection went up. That's because we killed so many big bulls on the late hunt. So, that's just, you know, I think we ought to look at this unit because I don't think we can figure it out. Because the best recommendation is just to issue more tags. That's just not the answer because the quality's going down as well. So, you know, we're here to support the recommendation. But I, you know, that might be my personal outlook because I spend so much time on the unit. But it is a problem. So I'd recommend that we keep the Wasatch at the 655 or whatever it is and not increase it. Just 1 year. Let's see what it does, you know. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any other comments from the audience? I know they had a similar concern up on the North Cache, and we stabilized the numbers on that one for a year to see what had happened. And so we can kind of see what works with that. But. Any other questions? Not questions, but comments from the audience. Okay, seeing none, bring it back to the RAC. Do you have any comments or? Yes, Danny.
Yeah, in looking at the recommended general season deer permits, I quickly looked at the list of the objective and the numbers that were just, I mean, off the chart for Chalk Creek, East Canyon, Morgan, South Ridge. You know, the objective is 18 to 20, and yet the three-year average is at almost 32. And yet the permit numbers are recommended to be the same. I know that there's some landowner issues there, but still, there is some public land, a little bit, and so harvesting those animals to bring it back into objective on other adjacent public lands, Forest Service, State Park, other lands. I'm just curious, maybe you could answer me on that one. Is that, I know we're out of the question.
That's fine. What was the question? I'm sorry.
Well, the question is why the heck are, I mean, it's way higher than anything else on the whole list at 32, and the objective is at the most 20, and yet the number of permits recommended are remaining the same. I don't get it.
Yeah, if I could provide a little background. On that unit, and there's a few others like that, the reason that those permits are stable is there's just so many private land areas that if you keep stacking hunters on top of each other in the limited public land portions of those units, we get a lot of negative feedback from that, from our hunting public. And so with the bulk of these 30 units, we really truly are trying to manage to the plan with the 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does, or 15 to 17 or whatever it is. But there are a couple exceptions, and that is where if we issue more tags, hunter success is going to decline, and then people are going to feel like we sold them camping trips instead of deer hunts. And so we're just trying to find that balance of how do we provide for a hunting public and give them legitimate opportunities. So a lot of those deer are on private lands, and so there's not public access.
That's what I said. But as an avid hunter in that area, I don't see those issues to be as significant as you're suggesting. I really don't.
Okay.
And the problem is that every 10 years, every decade, we have deep snow and we have just catastrophic loss.
Sure.
On that particular area where we find, you know, does and fawns just stacked up in the bottom of ravines that have starved to death, and that so the population drops and then it rebounds way back up again. I'm just wondering if there aren't other solutions to that problem.
Yeah, some of the solutions that we've tried to deal with are CWMU permits and other things like that to walk in access. We have programs that try to get public hunters on private lands, and so we're doing our best in that regard. But there's some units. Another good example would be 9 Mile Range Creek, where we're capped at 1,300 permits just because we feel like if we continue to throw hunters on that limited public ground, hunt success will go down, satisfaction will go down. So But Danny, I mean, as a RAC member, if you want to make a recommendation to increase on those units, I mean, that's your prerogative. I hopefully you can understand why we didn't increase. It's just the private lands issues. So.
Thank you. Yeah, I've actually had a chance to do one of those cow hunts that was mostly private and limited public opportunity, and the cows figured out pretty quick which ones they could stay off.
We have. Can I ask question to clarify something? Justin, on your trans, the arrows,
yeah.
How much does the trend play into your recommendation?
It does. A good example of the trend would be on the box elder unit. It's the fourth one down from the bottom where we're at 16 bucks per 100 does. According to the plan, we shouldn't be touching that. But we went from 20 bucks per 100 does to 15 to 11 in 3 years. And so we look at that and say, okay, we don't like that trend. We better get out in front of this. And so there's some of these permits that maybe don't add up as perfectly as you'd like, but trend is something that we take very serious because we want to get out ahead of these. We don't want buck to doe ratios to crash really hard. So, yeah. Did that help?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, we also like to recognize Calvin Crandall, who joined us this evening. He's one of the board members as well. I'm on the Wildlife Board. Any other questions from the... Well, we're in comment. In disposition. Go ahead.
Mr. So looking at, and Justin, maybe you can help me here and bring up the premium limited entry deer slide again.
Yeah.
Troy, I know you asked that we go back to 2013 numbers, but when you look at the objective, 40 to 55% is over 5 years, and you look at the trend, especially 2013, and the average being 72%. I think it's pretty tough for me to approve or to not accept the permit increases on the Henrys based on that. I would suggest that as the Mule Deer Committee is about to meet, that perhaps you look at some of these objectives, but I think it would be tough for me to agree with that recommendation on the Henrys. And on the central Manti, as far as the elk numbers, could you, Justin, maybe give us a little more discussion on that unit as far as why we're recommending an increase in permits on that unit?
Sure, the Central Mountains Manti one, is that correct?
Yeah, I believe so. Is that right, Troy?
Okay. Yeah, on the Central Mountains Manti, when you look at that, the average age the age in 2011 was 6.1, and then it went to 6.2, and then this last year it was 6.2. And so for us, it's fairly straightforward. If we're over objective, then we need to make recommendations to the RACs and board that are going to help get to objective. And so if we're slightly above, and I recognize we're slightly above, and we're talking about 0.2 of an age objective, but it's kind of, it's principle. If we have a management plan, we're going to try our hardest to manage to it, and if we're above it and we feel like we can increase that opportunity, that's why we came with that recommendation. So
kind of along the same lines, Troy, is there any special reason why your group has an issue with the permit numbers recommended based on the trend of the... Sure, absolutely.
I mean, some credence has to be put into what people are seeing. We sat in the same meeting a year ago, and take the Parker Mountains, for instance. The buck antelope counts were so high that we increased permits. What are we doing this time? We're cutting them. And so it's not a perfect science, and we understand that. And we recognize and support the division, and we're actually, their recommendations fall within the science of it, but we're just asking based upon what some of our members and that are seeing. So that's how it's substantiated.
Fair enough. Thank you. I think with the Central Mountains, I think the Parker was probably a little bit of a, I don't want to call it a special circumstance, but a little bit unique in what happened to some of the antelope there. And I tend to agree with you in that specific scenario. But it seems like with the Manti, the Central Manti, we've seen a trend of a steady increase. And to me, the permit numbers seem to be in line with that.
But one thing we did, too, and this isn't highlighted very well, but on the Central Mountains Manti, the increase, instead, in the past, we've had 65% of those tags be in the early and 35% be in the late. But the recommendation, they split it to where 60% would be in the early and 40% in the late. And what that does is it provides more opportunity, but in that later hunt, you have lower success rates. And so even though we're increasing 23 permits, there's a chance we would harvest less elk than if we kept it in that earlier split at 65 to 35. Yeah, sorry. On the Manti, with the recommendation to increase by 23 permits, the region also made a recommendation to put more of those permits in the later hunt, which has a lower success rate. And so it's not like by increasing by 23 permits, we're not going to necessarily kill 23 more elk. In fact, we may kill less than had we kept the original split that we had last year.
What is the success rate on that late on that unit?
I don't know. Can I get some help from what's the harvest success rate on the early versus late? I know it's lower, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
Somewhere between 6 and 9.
Early is... I don't know.
Early is 81%, and the late is 65%.
Yeah, so... And this probably doesn't matter, but on the Parker, one reason we're cutting permits there is we plan on transplanting a bunch of animals off. And every year we do that, we get some males. And so we just didn't want to keep that high level of harvest and take a bunch of males off as well. So we were kind of trying to be conservative with that. So
I know, and sorry, one more thing, guys, then I'm done. I know one gentleman had talked about the Wasatch elk numbers. Mm-hmm. I think that it's worth mentioning to the public, Justin, maybe talk about that a little more. I think the elk numbers there, if my memory and recollection serves me correct, have been way over objective for years. We've had a lot of ranchers and people that folks that have been affected by wildlife damage on that mm-hmm. unit. Yeah. And I know the target has been to reduce that population, and it's been kind of a problem that's persisted for a few years now. I wonder if you could talk about that a little more.
Yeah, there are two different issues, and I'll start with the bull permit portion first. The reason we recommended the increase on the Wasatch, again, if you look at the average ages, we're supposed to be managing for a 5.5 to 6-year-old bull. In 2011, we were 6.5. In 2012, we were 6.3. And last year, we were 6.9. And so our three-year average is 6.5. And so we felt like, again, where the management plan says to get to 5.5 to 6, we didn't see how we could do that without increasing permits. So that's the recommendation on the bulls. And then as far as total number of elk on that unit, we are over, I think. It's well over 20. It's over 2,000. I think it's closer to 2,500 elk that we're over on 17A, B, and C, the entire unit, and so yeah, I mean we're over objective, and
so yeah. So hunters should probably expect over a little bit of time to see a few less elk on that unit. I mean, that's the intention, right?
Yeah, the intention is to get to objective from our perspective. And that may be hard, especially when hunters have had a surplus of elk for years and years. And so when the division does our best efforts to try to get there, by design, there should be a decrease if we're doing it right. And I think that's hard for some of these guys that are used to seeing a lot more elk than quite frankly, we probably should have had. So.
You know, one of the other changes is when they made that a 5.5 to 6-year-old management, that's an opportunity unit. Mm-hmm. So to create more opportunity, give more people a chance to hunt, but not necessarily lots of monster bulls, just a few.
Yeah.
So.
Good point.
Good. Danny.
Good. Oh. Are we able to harvest the animals, the elk, off of the Wasatch where we're having the problems with over objective? Are they able to get on those grounds?
I think we're diving into the antlerless portion right now, and that'll be my next presentation. And I don't mind having the conversation, but sometimes when we do this, it muddies the waters. And so I'd love to answer your question after the next presentation, if that's all right. So
good, thanks. Danny.
Again, you know, one of the problems, and this is kind of where I was heading with the earlier comment that's related to the Wasatch, is that, you know, we have landowners that are just simply unwilling to work with the Division of Wildlife Resources, either through the cooperative management units or in any way. And in fact, some of these really large landowners are not allowing virtually any harvest. And I noticed one year on the antlerless hunts, and again I'll go there, that the division basically had the hunt go completely around one large landowner, almost in retaliation for his inability to work with the division. It was very obvious to me. So I'm just wondering again. I'll poke again. I think he allowed one hunter 2 years ago to go on 11,000 acres of land to hunt bull elk. I won't drop names, but I'm just wondering, is there any other way that we can work with these landowners to try to solve these obvious boom and bust scenarios?
I could probably give you a statewide answer where I've talked about CWMUs and some of that stuff. But if you want specifics on the private land issues on that, I'd probably have to turn that one to Kobe. So,
I'm sorry, I missed that
line. Oh. Yakking back there.
Leave him alone, John.
The conversation, Covey, is centered around what do we do with private landowners on the Wasatch that don't allow access, that are harboring elk? Specifically, what do we do to work with those guys?
You get all your buddies and you walk the road with their horses and their guns.
You know, Danny, I think you're very familiar with... Is everybody this tall? Or am I just so short? I think you're very familiar with the division having several programs and incentives for private landowners. And we work hard to get access with walk-in access, CWMUs, landowner associations, and trying to tailor and make new programs. And we'll continue to do that to allow public access and get these sportsmen where they need to be. But that's really where we are, and that's the effort that we've made. Sometimes the value of the land exceeds, especially on the Wasatch, land can be very valuable. And there are people that are very hesitant to let public onto their private, valuable land. And the amount of compensation that we can give is not in line with the value they place on the ground. We'll work on it.
Larry?
Why is it always that you presume all the elk are on the private land? This is towards him. Why are you presuming all the elk?
I'm not presuming. In fact, I think that there's adequate opportunity to harvest elk on adjacent properties, land that is public land, even albeit for a moment before they run onto private land and are safe.
I know the Northeastern Unit has done some deals to try to drive, have the private landowner drive the elk off the private land to give the public access to those elk. And so they are actually working on it. But it's the elk, it always looks better behind, everything's great on the other side of a closed gate, and it's not always that way.
Thank you, Larry.
If I can just make one more comment. One thing that our agency's been really aggressive with is habitat projects. And the Wasatch is no exception. And so I think by improving public land and working with our federal partners and sportsmen and things like that, if you can create habitats that can draw elk in, I think that's a great benefit for deer and elk. And so that's one thing that probably isn't talked enough about, that we do try to grow elk on public lands. So.
Thank you, Justin. I'll entertain a motion from the REC. Chris. Motion is made by Chris, to seconded by Larry. All those in favor? Give me a second longer. Okay, all those opposed? Okay, seven. The motion passes. Seven in favor, one against. Okay, we'll now have the antler list permit recommendations. That will also be Justin. We'll turn the time over to him again.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tonight I'll present the antler list recommendations for 2014. Similar to the last presentation, we'll go over deer to begin. And I wanted to show this graph one more time, the fawn production over the last 15 years. And the thing that I'd really like you to focus on is the last 5 years or so, where we've been very stable in our fawn production, about 61 to 65 fawns per 100 does. But with fawn production, that's only half the story. The other half is survival. And so this really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the overall recommendations of the night, but this is something that our agency is really proud of and that we've put a lot of effort into, and that is not only trying to figure out what's been produced, but what is actually surviving. And so over the last 4 or 5 years, we've radio-collared hundreds of deer on 7 or 8 units annually. And we radio-collar, from that radio-collar data, we're able to get survival rates. And as you can see, for adults, over the last 4 years, we've been between 84 and 86%, which is about average for Western states, maybe a little bit average, above average on those years where it's 86. But the fawn production has been a different story. In 2010 and 2011, just over half of the fawns that we radio collared each winter were surviving to the next winter. And then the last 2 years has been quite a bit different. Almost 80% of the fawns that we've radio collared have survived. And with that, what you get is you get better information as to if your populations are increasing, decreasing, or being stagnant. In the last couple of years, they have been increasing. Right now, we're just under 333,000 deer statewide. Our plan objective is 350,000. And things have been really good in relation to production and survival of mule deer. So with that background on how the herds are doing, I want to recommend the antlerless deer permits for the state. This year we're recommending an increase of 105 from 305 permits to 410. The bulk of that is taking place on the Monroe, where in the Sevier Valley they have a lot of resident deer that are causing damage to agricultural fields, and the division wanted to use public hunters to try to tackle that. Other than that, though, no new hunts or boundary changes, pretty much same as last year with what we're doing for antlerless deer. For elk, a little different story. Last year we increased by about 1,600 elk. We're just over 81,000, and before that we were just under 80,000. Our population objective statewide is just under 71,000, so we're growing some elk. This is a question we get asked quite a bit is, we're over objective as an agency, but where? And I wanted to put this together to kind of highlight this. And so in the northern region and northern region, that's where the bulk of our challenges are in staying, you know, with objective. And a lot of that we've talked about tonight, some issues with private lands and other public access challenges. Northeast region, they've got some challenges as well with tribes and different things like that. And then southeast region, central and southern, we're about where we need to be relative to the population objectives. So what are we doing with antlerless elk permits? This year we're recommending 16,715. It's a slight decrease from last year. And this graph is almost counterintuitive because I just showed you that we're over, but we're cutting permits, and so it warrants an explanation. And one thing that the regions have done this year, which I thought was really good, is they took a look at all of their hunts, and we had hunts that had success rates in the teens and the single digits, and we looked at those and said, why do we keep forcing hunters into these areas with lots of permits? And so we pulled a lot of those out, and we started putting more hunters, more permits in hunts that had higher success rates. And so we wanted to look at this from a smarter point of view instead of just the idea that you just throw more tags at it and that solves the problem. So that was one of the steps we took. Another step we took that doesn't show up as a public draw permit is depredation and mitigation permits. And so as we've talked about, if we are growing elk on private lands, let's be a little more liberal and aggressive with those permits that we're giving private landowners. They can harvest some elk on their property, put some pressure and kick elk out onto the public lands. And try that as well. And then the third thing that we're recommending is antlerless elk control permits. And this is a program we've done for several years now. And what it is if you have an antlered permit, a buck, a bull, a once-in-a-lifetime permit, you can buy an antlerless elk control permit at a reduced price. And it is good for the season date and the hunt boundary of your antlered permit. And so we have three units in the state where the objective is zero: the Henry Mountains, the North Santa Fe, and portions of the San Juan, the Any Bull unit. And then nine units where, as we've talked about, it's difficult to get adequate harvest to control the populations. And so we have this occurring on the Nine Mile Range Creek, East Canyon, Chalk Creek, Morgan Southridge, South Slope Yellowstone, Wasatch Current Creek, and the Wasatch of Inequin. And for this year, we're recommending the Ogden, which would be a new unit. They just surveyed their area, and they have more elk than they're comfortable with, and then the Wasatch West as well. And with the Wasatch West, this probably takes some explanation as well. We've pulled over 1,000 permits, public draw permits, off that unit. And the idea behind it, so I mean, this graph here going back a little bit, had we kept those permits in, we would have been same as last year. But the idea was to pull those out of the public draw and to allow buck and bull hunters on the Wasatch be able to harvest these elk on their summer and transitional ranges. And so that's the approach we'd like to take. As far as new hunts and boundary changes, there's some hunts that already existed. We just added a different hunt to it, meaning a later 9-day season or something like that. And that was on the Yellow Slope, West Agate, Mount Dutton, and the South Manti. Additionally, we had some units that just required some boundary changes. This was the other thing we wanted to do, hunts that we felt like they had lower success. We wanted to extend the dates or make the boundaries more friendly. And so Fair and Lower, Gordon Creek, Price Canyon, these are aimed at, if you have an open winter like we had this year, allow hunters to get up a little higher where the elk are at. Also, the Wasatch 17B and C, the Current Creek and Aviniquin, we want to change the boundary on the antlerless elk control permit to match the deer boundary. We got a lot of good feedback this last year from people that had that tag, but one of their suggestions, which I think was a good one, was if I have my deer permit and I'm in this boundary, I should be able to perform antlerless elk control on all of it and not have a boundary that doesn't match my deer boundary. And so to help with that, we want to change the elk boundary. And then finally, a simple name change on the South Slope Bonanza Vernal. Next, we have brand new hunts that required additional boundary changes. Beaver Valley and Cacharon Valley, this is aimed at getting some depredating elk that we'd like to use public permits for to help. The Monroe, Mount Dutton, and Plateau, this is a pretty big boundary, but what we found is we were playing ping pong with these elk, where you'd hunt them on the Monroe and they'd run to the Dutton, then you'd have a hunt on the Dutton and they'd run back to the Monroe. They're all the same elk, and so we said let's just let guys hunt them where they're at. Chalk Creek combined a lot of units into one. Ogden, adding some new hunts there, and then the Plateau, Fish Lake, Thousand Lakes, letting them hunt the entire unit instead of breaking them into the east or west. For doe pronghorn, pretty big cuts in permit. The bulk of these cuts are coming from the northern region where they've surveyed and they feel like their pronghorn populations aren't what they've been, and so they want to cut back a little bit on permits. And then antlerless moose permits again, and we're recommending zero for this year. So for new hunts and boundary changes for doe pronghorn, last November when we met, we changed the boundaries for buck pronghorn on the Plateau and the Cache Morgan Southridge Ogden. We'd like to match the doe boundaries to that buck boundary, and then a slight change to the Mount Dutton Ponsagant boundary to preserve some pronghorn in Johns Valley. And that's all I have. Thank you. And as questions come up, on some of this antlerless stuff, it's really hard for me to know these individual areas. And so if there's localized questions, probably give those to Kobe. If there's statewide questions, I'm more than happy to try to tackle those. So.
Thank you. Any questions or points of clarification from the rep? Yes?
I have a question. When you give an additional permit to someone that has a bull tag, what's the harvest rate with those?
Yeah, it varies by unit. I think last year we issued 23,000 and we killed over 500.
It's really small.
Yeah, it's probably close to 20%, right around there. What's that?
23,000.
What did I say?
23,000.
Forgive me. Yeah, it's 2,300, yeah. Yeah. Thanks, John.
I think on the other two units on the Wasatch, to look at something that's more comparable, they're about 30% is what they are. So they sold about 1,300 tags and harvested over 300, so it's about 30%.
How does that compare with someone that just has a cow tag?
It really depends on seasonality. These other hunts, the general season cow hunts that are earlier in the year, are 30. Ours last year was 37%. So that time of year, they're about mid-30s, where it's not concentrated winter range elk. So it's pretty comparable, I would say.
And the late hunts really vary depending on weather now.
The late hunts vary huge because success can be really high or it can be zero. where these hunts are more consistent and predictable.
Mr. Chair, can I give one more point of clarification?
Yes, go ahead, Justin.
In my presentation, I failed to mention this, but one of the advantages of antlerless elk control permits is we've talked about stacking hunters on top of each other. That isn't the case with these. You have hunters that are already in the field either for their spike hunt or their buck hunt and things like that, and it's just an additional opportunity. And so this required some creative thinking because we thought, how do we get more harvest without adding more hunters? And so that's one of the real benefits that we get from a program like this.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Larry?
Just a clarification. If you have a spike elk hunt tag, you can hunt the cow. Then can you also hunt that cow during the deer hunt with a buck tag?
Yeah. So if you have a buck deer tag, you can hunt that cow during that season framework.
Both hunts.
Yeah, if you didn't harvest it during your rifle spike hunt, yes. Yeah.
Is this going to help you get into your line of your objective?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Is this going to help get in line with your objective on the elk numbers?
We hope so. I mean, that's what we'd like to do is explore new options, because the idea of just throwing more permits at it and having low success hunts was pretty unappetizing. And so this was a way to say we have all these hunters in the field already. They're seeing elk on the summer and transitional ranges, and let's try it. Let's open it up. And if hopefully we get into some of these elk to where we get back down to our objective, and it could just be a positive management tool for us.
You're still trying to get it to the objective, the 71,000.
Yeah, on the Wasatch.
Yes.
Yeah,
statewide.
Yes. I and that's why we're exploring this on so many areas, is because it's had some success and we've got positive feedback on it, and I think managing to these objectives is important for us, and so if we can use more tools, we'll do it.
So, any other questions? I think it's a good idea to reduce the numbers with less people. More people never helps anything, you know, out in the woods. Unless you guys who hunt.
We hit a lot of diminishing returns and permit numbers and actually harvested less. Yeah. 2013, 2012.
Yeah. Any other questions or points of clarification from the RAC? Okay, we'll turn it over to the audience. Do you have any questions from the audience or points of clarification on the presentation? Okay, I don't have any comment cards. Are there any out there that are not in yet? Any comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the rack.
Yeah.
Danny.
I'd like to make a motion that we accept this proposal as... They can hear me.
No, I can't hear you when I
listen. They can hear me. They can't hear him. It's a microphone. I make a motion that we accept this recommendation as proposed, since I was opposed to the previous.
Okay. Motion by Danny to accept. Seconded by George. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Justin. All right, our next one is the Analyst CWMU Voucher Permit Recommendations for 2014, and we'll have Scott McFarland making this presentation.
Mr. Chairman, RAC members, I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the Division. And this evening I will be presenting the 2014 CWMU Antlerless Voucher Permit View and Review and Recommendations. The reason it's split into voucher and permit is because the CWMUs receive their permits as a voucher that are redeemed for a permit, and the public receive theirs as a permit through the draw process. Just as an overview, 42 CWMUs have CORs that are previously approved. All of our CWMUs are on three-year management plans, so those numbers are approved for 3 years, and unless they change them, and the CWMUs do have the opportunity to change those on an annual basis. in response to changing numbers, wildlife numbers. So what they do is they have this opportunity. It can be, the request can come from the division to change those, or it can come from the CWMU. And 9 CWMUs have requested changes to previously approved numbers. There's also 9 CWMUs that require wildlife board approval for antlerless recommendations for their new 3-year CORs. These were approved for bucks and bulls last fall, and they need approval during this antlerless process for their antlerless numbers also. So in summary, we have the CWMU's total across the state are requesting 312 vouchers that go to the CWMU for antlerless permits and 1,224 antlerless permits for a total of 1,536 for all species statewide for antlerless. Sometimes there's a little bit of confusion on how the splits the ratio of public to private permits. How many go to the CWMU and how many go to the public? If this is determined during the bucks and bull process, and whatever allocation they choose for bucks and bulls affects what the antlerless split would be. For example, if they choose a 90-10 private public split, the public gets 100% of all of the antlerless tags that are offered for that CWMU. If they go to an 85-15 split, the CWMU would receive 25% of the antlerless permits offered for the unit, and the public would receive 75, so on. And that's for deer and elk. For pronghorn and moose also, it's always a 60-40 split. They don't have the opportunity to choose a split on that. And as a result of that, the CWMU would receive 40% of the antlerless permits, and 60% of those would go to the public. So currently we don't have any moose antlerless permits offered on CWMUs at this time, so I did not put that up there. Okay, so I'll go quickly through the recommendations by region. Most of these are renewals. Nine were renewals and nine were changes. But in the northern region, we had quite a few renewals. There's one, the Hartscrabble CWMU is in a new category because it changed ownership, but it is an older CWMU. Most of the numbers that are shown here are for elk antlerless. And most of those are the same numbers that were approved in the last 3-year plans. So, and they are the Grass Valley Clark Canyon CWMU. These are all newer renewals. Grouse Creek, Hartscrabble, Jacobs Creek, Mountain Top, and Woodruff Creek South. And those are all renewal applications. And the Deseret CWMU asked for a pretty significant change in their antlerless numbers. They want to go to 160 elk from 260. They dropped dropped 100 permits off there. And they also asked for a decrease in their doe pronghorn antlerless permits. On the DWR recommendation part of this, it says approve on all these. We recommend approval. When we say we recommend approval on that, it's a joint recommendation between it's an agreement between the CWMUs and the division on the numbers that are posted here. So, the southeastern region, we had some renewals, a few renewals and some changes. All of these in the southeast region are elk antlerless permit changes or renewals. All the changes they're asking for a decrease in their current permit allocations on their 3-year management plans. Most of this is due to changing populations. We've asked the CWMUs in a lot of cases to step up and take more and more permits, and the CWMUs are generally smaller pieces of property. There's a 10,000 acre minimum for those, and so if they hunt them really hard, the elk learn to not be there, so we have to keep changing the antlerless permits on there. So we would like to maintain at least a reasonable amount of success on these antlerless hunts on the CWMUs. So these are in the southeastern region, would be Menomod Ridge, Red Ranchers. Those are both renewals. We recommend approval of those posted numbers. Emma Park, Preston Nutter Ranch, Conover Jensen, Spring Creek Dodge, and Summit Point. All of those requested a reduction in their antlerless elk permits. We recommend approval of all those. For the southern region, there was just two of them. Black Point is a Black Point CWMU is a pronghorn CWMU. They maintain the same, asked for the last numbers they had on their last application. It's a renewal. We recommend approval of that. And Alton asked for a slight increase in elk antlerless permits. We recommend approval of that one also. For this, the central region, we have the Heaston and the 3C. These are both change applications. Both of those requested a reduction in their elk antlerless permits. And we recommend approval of those. So as an overview, statewide for recommended CWMU antlerless permits, we have one CWMU in northern Box Elder County that has requested, this is already approved on their CWMU management plan, 10 two-doe permits. That's the only CWMU that currently has antlerless deer permits. For elk, the private permits for the CWMUs would be 238 elk antlerless permits and 1,090 public permits for elk. And pronghorn would be 74 private permits, pronghorn doe permits, and 122 public pronghorn doe permits. So total permits statewide in the CWMU program would have 312 private antlerless permits for all species and 1,224 public permits for all species. With that, that's all I have. Thank you.
Scott, any questions or points of clarification from the RAC? Danny.
Scott, I don't know if you were listening to me earlier about the East Canyon area. I'd just like you to respond to my concerns, mostly about one landowner there. We've got the McFarlands, the McFarlands there have...
No relation.
Yeah, honest. I know. I'm just teasing. The McFarlands have a CWMU adjacent to this landowner, and they're doing an excellent job of doing what they need to do there. But anyway, I just thought you might want to comment, because you did earlier.
What was the question?
Well, we're... We're way over objective on both deer and elk, and we keep experiencing these catastrophic losses. And I think the solution with these cooperative management units is the way to go. But apparently there are landowners there that just are not willing to cooperate, apparently under any circumstances, and it's just causing us all kinds of havoc.
Okay. Well,
should I just shoot them or what? No.
Well, that wouldn't be the best plan of attack. But this is a unit that I dealt with. I was a biologist over that area for a number of years, and I understand what you're saying. The private lands, the East Canyon unit, if I remember correctly, it's about 95% private land in the entire unit. And so we're dealing with private landowners and people that view their property as their backyard. And it's just like if you want to be able to control who goes into your backyard, and I think that they do also. And I think the key to managing these populations is putting the permits in the hands of the people that have the ability to harvest them. That's why we go with the mitigation permit program. We go with the CWMU program. But we also try and educate the landowners as the need to harvest these because we can't force them to put hunters onto their property unless they have to do it willingly. So we look for incentives to do that and educate them. And other than that, we really don't have a lot of tools. And we have worked with some of the landowners with walk-in access specifically for elk hunts in that area. And we've used just about every tool that we can on that. Elk seems to be the problem. I think their deer population is probably right in line with their population objectives right now. So, I've been involved with. Is it really?
It's the highest.
Okay. Yeah, so, we can until they offer permits for. One of the things that was going on with the East Canyon unit was that they were looking at adjusting the population objective because it wasn't really realistically based on the habitat available for them. So that's one of the things I think when they do the management plan, they're going to adjust that population objective. But private lands are absolutely a problem when we're trying to harvest antlerless animals, because there's no matter how what you do, there is going to be some resistance to allowing public or whoever on their property to harvest the animals unless they have to be willing to do it.
Scott, it actually goes farther than that. This one particular landowner, 11,000 acres, is actually abusing the public who are legally hunting on public ground around his property, and it's just not right. You know, it's got to the point where, you know, grandfather and his grandkid can't, you know, walk on public ground without being abused by a landowner.
If
someone's doing a legal hunt, they should be able to be not bothered by someone who's interfering with their hunt.
Yeah, if
Danny, that is a law enforcement issue, that's
sure.
Not these.
Yeah, and if this person is enrolled in the CWMU program, then we do have a complaint process and a way to take care of that problem. But if he's not, it's not something we can do. So
you're right.
Right. Any other questions from the RAC or points of clarification?
Yeah, I just got.
Hopefully, this is a question that probably somebody here can answer. How many limited entry bull elk tags are given to all the various groups in the state to auction or for raffles and for limited entry deer too? Because we don't ever hear that in this meeting, you know, this particular meeting. Does anybody know that's Colvin somebody?
That's probably something I'd have to have Justin address. I think he's more involved. He's a lot more involved with that program.
How many total permits for limited entry elk and limited entry deer go through the conventions and the different...
It's 200 total permits, but that's a lot of species. I bet it's close to 40 deer and 40 elk, just off the top of my head. I can look it up, but it's around there.
Okay.
So. And those come out of the draw, the public draw. So.
Right. Okay.
Any other questions? Questions from the audience? Do you have a card?
No. I'm not going to make a comment unless it's in my question.
Okay.
My name's Mike Christensen. I think I have a question that pertains to CWMU antlerless tags. I noticed in the southeastern region that those CWMUs were decreasing their permits because of, like the graph Justin showed, it showed that the elk population destabilized or even declined.
Mm-hmm.
But on that same graph, in the northern region, that was the region that had the highest population above objective. Yet, why aren't the CWMUs harvesting or putting out more permits on their CWMUs to deal with those with that over-objective population?
I can speak to that somewhat. I don't manage all of the CWMUs in there, but for example, the Deseret Land Livestock, the Deseret CWMU has asked for a 100 permit reduction. They've had a change in management up there. We also haven't had a survey, a helicopter survey on the unit for, I believe it's been almost, it's 6 to 7 years now, because they keep missing because of weather events. And so they've asked that they could back off 100 on there just because of that, because they have been previously had 260 permits on there, and they've usually averaged about 90% success on there. They've harvested pretty heavy, and so they've asked just for a year to look at it until they get a count. The other ones, the CW...
Couldn't Deseret's reasoning for lowering their permits be because they changed their buck-bull split?
No, the permits, the number of permits stays the same. The number go to the public and private.
No, they changed from 85-15 to...
Right.
90-10. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't have any. All the permits on the Deseret go to the public. So.
Yeah. Now. Yeah.
But that wasn't the reason for changing that, because of the permit split. So.
Okay.
But at least that's what they told me. So
there's no way to get the CWMUs in the northern region to take more cow elk tags to reduce that population objective, because we hear this statewide that it's a. You know, that we're over by thousands of elk over the population objective, so then we harvest elk all over, but we're not harvesting them in the northern region on the CWMUs, which are harboring the elk, if that makes sense.
Well, and the CWMUs aren't totally harboring the elk. Putting more permits on the CWMUs a lot of times doesn't mean that that's going to make more elk harvested. Like I say, these are normally, they're 10,000 acres or short, slightly over that, and once you start harvesting those, the elk learn that they don't come in there certain times a year. And so what we do is we encourage the CWMUs to change their plans around to harvest those, but if the harvest keeps going down and down, and it's not because of they're trying to not harvest them, it's just that the elk become less and less available in a lot of cases. So. And we'd like to maintain a fairly good harvest rate. If it gets down, you know, to 10 or 20%, people really don't want to put in for the CWMU permits, because it's really not that good of a hunt. So one of the things we put on the website is they can usually expect these to be a little bit higher success hunts, you know, because it's limited on the number of people that go into these. So.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions from the audience? Any comments from the audience? Yes.
I just had a question about these permits.
State your name, please.
Craig Bonham from Draper, Utah. I just had a question about these permits that are given to these organizations that auction them off at these banquets. Do these organizations pay a set fee for these permits? Or do they... I mean, say, for example, Mule Deer Foundation, if they obtained a beaver premium tag for elk, do they pay like $5,000 for it, or do they, and then they take and auction it off?
90% of the money raised goes back to wildlife.
90%?
Yeah, they're able to retain for their administrative costs 10% the amount that they're auctioned off for.
Is it possible that a member of the Mule Deer Foundation, or I'm just using that as an example, could acquire one of those permits and then it didn't go to auction and they were able to buy it themselves? We kind of wondered if that was happening during one of the banquets this year. What's that?
They would have to submit a bid at the auction.
So it has to be auctioned off at the public level. They can't just buy them for themselves. So we thought that maybe one of the Deep Creek tags had that happen at the Delta banquet this year. But so
I know at some of the banquets they offer them, they'll have like an online auction and open it up that way, as well as the public auction right there at the banquets. I know they do it both ways, but it does have to be auctioned if they get it for a conservation tag.
I think it's a great program that we've got, and a lot of money's coming back to go to the right places. So I appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments? Yes.
Richard, I told you wrong. It was closer to 40 deer and closer to 90 elk on that. So,
Thanks, Justin. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the rep for your discussion and disposition.
We're looking at that side.
Looking at that side, is this the side?
I'll make the proposal. Do we accept the division's recommendations?
Motion is made by Richard, seconded by Larry. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. I have a question. Yeah, our next RAC meeting will be May 13th. We'll be talking about fishing, upland game, wild turkey, waterfowl guidebook, and then a bunch of on turkey management. The board meeting where they'll make final decisions on these things will be held on May 1st at 9 a.m. at the division office. I do have one question for somebody. I've getting a lot of people asking me about why it's taken so long to get the results for the draws this year, since it's pretty much a computer process and the numbers have been in and we're still a month and a half away from learning anything. Does anybody...
You haven't approved the permit numbers.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. That's what you're talking about now, is permit numbers.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's speed it up.
No, it seems like it's, you know, before we couldn't do it because we didn't have the information gathered, and then I realized the recommendations and stuff, but for those of us who like to dream and plan ahead, and for all of the other people who asked, I needed to come back with an answer to that question. And we appreciate all of you who have come here tonight and commented. Well, do you have anything else from the RAC? Anything? Anybody? Okay.
Second.
Motion to adjourn, seconded.